Fenella Kernebone with you, and welcome to By Design, the summer special, right here on RN. Coming up today, what typeface can be everyone's type and designed to attract every one of your senses? Sight, hearing, smell, touch, taste. Now, other than possibly food, what other design aims to target all of your senses? In our panel today, we explore the thinking that goes into the design of sensory gardens. Plus, you'll take a trip to the incredible Abu Dhabi Mosque, the largest in the United Arab Emirates, the size of 5 football fields.
As you can see here from the main gate, 3 big domes at the middle of the place. And this is something that is related to the Mughal design of mosques. Maybe you could say it's similar to Taj Mahal. You can see that there are 2 reflective pools at the sides, huge reflective pools actually, 2 tall towers at the corners of the building.
More about this magnificent building, the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque, when By Design heads in the field. But what's your font? Are you a Helvetica kind of person? A century Gothic, Arial, or maybe you even have your own font? The design possibilities for typography in the alphabet that I use every day, the Latin alphabet, is seemingly endless. But for my first guest today, that variety has been lacking in Arabic script and can even impact on literacy. Nadine Shaheen's award-winning work, known for harmonising the relationship between the Latin alphabet and Arabic type, as well as her approach to contemporary Arabic script, has been groundbreaking. Her typeface, Kufiya, was the first to include matching Arabic and Latin parts, and she also designed the new typeface for Beirut's leading newspaper. She's an Arabic specialist at Monotype in Germany, and her typefaces are sold worldwide. Nadine Shaheen, welcome to By Design.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the beginning. When did you start to become interested in typography? What was your kickstart into this world?
I was studying graphic design at the American University of Beirut, and it was in my second year, and we had an Arabic typography class and a most amazing calligrapher and art critic who was our teacher, and he introduced us to the world of Arabic calligraphy and the richness of the heritage that we have, and that was contrasted by the poor quality of the typefaces that were available to us as designers, and that contrast was sort of like a call for action.
Tell me what that poor quality is. Describe that for me. What was the signage like on the streets of Beirut?
You had the poor quality in terms of design aesthetics, so typefaces that were poorly drawn, designs that were poorly executed, not really well put together. But you also had a problem with the lack of expression. So you had very conservative designs that were already badly designed. Or when you're working with typefaces, they are like voices that you can use in portraying a certain message. And when you are working as a graphic designer, you utilize this personality and this voice in order to express what you want to express in that project. With the Arabic typefaces that we had, it was almost like having one pair of shoes for both summer and winter. And we needed more variation, more ability to express how we live and how we want to live. And all of that was just really not available for us.
I like this idea of only having one pair of shoes for all seasons. So not only did you need more expression, to use your words, you know, more voices that you can use to portray a message, but what was the other problem that emerges from this in terms of legibility, the capacity for people to be able to simply read?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we already have a problem of literacy in the Middle East, where literacy rates are not very high. The amount of books that people are reading in every day is so low, it's embarrassing. There was a study last year. I was shocked when I saw the numbers. So the averages for how many books people read per year is in the number of pages, not in the number of books. And even in that is very low. So it's really embarrassing. So we don't have a culture of people picking up books and reading for pleasure.
Yet there's a very strong history of Arabic script and writing.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So the calligraphy itself is very advanced, is very rich, but reading as a pastime is simply not there. Because you had 500, 600 years of what we call the Dark Ages in the Middle East, where there was very little cultural output, and the 20th century came as an awakening of the Arab region, but still there's a long, long way to go, and we need to encourage reading. And then when you pick up a book, book and the typeface is not well designed, you couldn't get, you know, eye fatigue, you can get headaches, it just doesn't invite you. If you are a child and you want to pick up a book to read a story, if the typeface looks, you know, too complex for you or does not fit with what a child is interested in terms of aesthetics, they're not going to be interested in reading the book. And that's not what we should be doing. We should be encouraging them and presenting material in ways that captures their imagination.
And by simply redesigning the way the type is in the first place so that it is easy to read, you can actually increase and improve literacy. It seems like kind of a no-brainer, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But for some reason, nobody had been looking at that. So when I was doing my MA, I did a paper about the simplification and script reform of the Arabic script. And there were times in our history, in the mid of the 20th century, where people were saying, look, we need to simplify the script so that people are able to read. And then some people were saying, no, just dump it completely and pick up the Latin script because this is too complex for us to use in everyday. And none of this happened, but the script did have some sort of typographic simplification. And so we ended up with many different variations of how we can create typefaces for Arabic, some that are more simple, some that are more complex. And these days, these technological constraints are no longer there, but you have the question, what is more legible? And of course, you can design it. A good design typeface, a well-designed typeface in any of these levels of complexity. But we still need to answer the question, what is easier to read? That's what I did for my PhD. So I spent 5 years working on this topic and looking at the effect of the complexity of the script on legibility, using eye tracking, using tests with school children. And it turns out, yeah, what is more complex takes more time to read. It's common sense to get to this conclusion. But now we have scientific proof that it is that way, and that helps guide our efforts.
On By Design, I'm speaking with an Arabic specialist at Monotype in Germany, whose typefaces are sold worldwide. And her work has basically been described as a combination of harmonizing Latin and Arabic type, as well as contemporizing Arabic script. And it seems quite fascinating to me, this PhD research, Nadine, that you've done, that actually has resulted in some new scripts, some new fonts. And one of these is the font called Kufia, which apparently was the very first to include matching Arabic and Latin parts. Tell me what that means.
Kufia is sort of, for me, is more than a typeface. It's more of a political view on life and cultural exchange between the Middle East and the Western world. We've had a lot of trouble. I mean, anybody who hears the news knows about the way things are when you are an Arab. It's just has not been easy for us. And the cultural dialogue and people talk about cultural wars and clash of civilizations. But what if we had dialogue of civilizations rather than a clash? When I was graduating from EUB, the keynote speaker at my graduation was Edward Said, the late Edward Said, and he talked about this. He was the one who raised up that when we as Arabs today, what can we do? He was saying, like, you can take different approaches to discuss different cultures. You can either copy them, you can oppose them, or you can engage in dialogue. The interesting thing for us to do would be to engage in the dialogue. And that sort of idea I took on, and I think that was the most influential speech I ever heard in my entire life, and sort of took it as a working methodology or ideology for me, for my design. And Kufia embraces that. Even though the Arabic script is very different from the Latin script, they are meant to live on the same page together in harmony and in dialogue. We need to understand that they are different and accept that they are different and that this is okay. But we need to find avenues where we can create this harmony, where we can get them to coexist without fighting. And that you do by having a good and solid understanding of how they are built.
It might be hard to describe then visually what this is, but can you describe it for me?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have two people and they are going to have a conversation and one of them is standing up and the other one is lying down, they can't really have a conversation for a very long time because it's just really not sustainable. What needs to happen is the person who is standing up needs to sit down. And the person who's lying down needs to sit up. So basically, they are both sitting. And this is what happens with Arabic. Arabic has a very horizontal emphasis in terms of the way the strokes move across the line. Latin has a very strong vertical rhythm. It's been likened to 26 soldiers of lead. That's one of the books describing the rhythm in Latin. It's very vertical. When we write the I or the L or the H, M, N, all of these are very strong vertical strokes. So what you do You introduce elements that are vertical. You emphasize the verticality in Arabic and you emphasize the horizontality in the Latin while keeping the structure the same. We don't want to have Frankensteins, right? We don't want to copy and paste parts. We want to make a full working person. So when you're designing a letter, it's a code that people understand and need to recognize because this is what they are reading. It's not an art piece sitting on a wall. They have to read and understand what this character means. So every person has in his mind an understanding of what the letter A looks like. If you come and change that shape, it's not recognizable as the letter A anymore. It might look pretty, but they won't recognize it. It's the same as you have a person. You have the head, the shoulders, the main body. They have certain proportions to one another. They're all built around the same skeletal. And that's the same with letter forms. If we do not understand the basic structure, we will end up with monsters. We work with the basic structure, keep it the same, keep it recognizable, but just emphasize a little bit elements here and there so that you create a dialogue between the two different entities.
So what was the impact?
Good. Basically, you get an Arabic that looks paradoxically modern, even though it's based on the oldest calligraphic style in Arabic. So a calligraphic style that was in use 1300 years ago. That was my source of inspiration. And a Latin that looks like a traditional text face. But you put them together on the same page and you feel the same sense of motion and the same sense of rhythm between the two. One of my teachers used to explain that when we are designing a typeface, there's a wind that blows through the typeface. And what you need to do is to have that same rhythm blowing at the same speed. Designing a typeface family with different script systems is almost like you have two people that are taking a walk together. They need to walk along the same line and at the same speed, even though each one of them is different, but they are walking together. You get, for example, a whole paragraph in Arabic, and then you have one Latin word in the middle. It could be the name of a book or a URL or an email. And usually what happens is that the Latin pops out because it looks so foreign in terms of movement than the Arabic. But in Kufiya, you have one rhythm and one sense of gray that nothing pops out. As the typeface comes, it looks as if they are belonging together. So you start reading the Arabic and suddenly there's a...
You're reading the Latin and our eyes are moving cohesively.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's not that you're looking at a text and different things are jumping up and down because they are not fitting with the background that they are sitting with.
Nadine, just to wrap up, I mean, I simply want to ask you what you think is the future for Arabic typography.
I think more experimentation, more pushing what we can do and exploring more. It's almost like it's a very big field. We've only had a few baby steps and there's so many more amazing things for us to discover that we just need the time to sit and play.
I wish I had more time to sit and chat with you. I must admit, it's wonderful to chat with you and to talk about your designs on By Design. Thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you for the invitation.
Nadine Shaheen there, a typographer and Arabic specialist at Monotype, and she has quite incredible work. More information on our website. Up next, a look at a modern-day architectural wonder, one of the largest mosques in the world.
You're with Fenella Kernebone, here on RN. And this is By Design.
On By Design here on RN, that is from an album from Alila Diane that came out this year. That track is called Rose and Thorn, and a bit of a teaser, I suppose, with the title of that song for our panel coming up very soon in the program all about sensory gardens. Now, the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque in Abu Dhabi is the largest mosque in the United Arab Emirates, and it's the eighth largest in the world. It really is a megastructure, containing the largest handmade carpet in the world, and is built from materials that include magnificent jewels and rare treasures. The dome also is the biggest of any in the world, and the mosque site itself is approximately the size of 5 football fields, so I think you can get a sense of just how big this incredible modern building actually is. Timothy Nicastri is on site at Abu Dhabi's Grand Mosque, known as the Pearl of the Arabian Gulf because of its expansive white facade. He's with Mohammed Al-Hashemi, a tour guide from the mosque's cultural centre.
So, Mohammed, we're standing near the fountains at the front of the building, the beautiful marble facade in front of us, and towering minarets, the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque. Is a combination of different kinds of Muslim architecture throughout history. Tell me about its namesake.
Sure. The Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque is named after the late president of the country. He is the one who has formed the UAE in 1971. The idea of building the mosque itself came in 1986 by the same man. His idea at that time was to create an Islamic temple, a mosque, that has international features so that people from all over the world can come to here to see their own, let's say, fingerprints, and at the same time to know something about Islam as a religion. And that was the main concept of tolerance and coexistence between cultures and civilizations. Because you can see here from the main gate, 3 big domes at the middle of the place. And this is something that is related to the Mughal design of mosques. Maybe you could say it's similar to Taj Mahal. You can see that there are 2 reflective pools at the sides, huge reflective pools actually, 2 tall towers at the corners of the building. The minaret itself, it starts with a rectangular shape and then it goes to an octagon shape and then goes to a cylindrical shape. Different eras of Islam and different architecture designs from different parts of the Islamic country throughout the history.
Wow, I'm just seeing the main courtyard, piazza kind of area. White marbles glistening in the morning sun and the mosaic on the ground. It's just a sea of this textured, floral, beautifully carved marble. You know, what looks like paintings is all precious stone flecks. We've just come through the main gateway. As I understand it, within Abu Dhabi there is almost 2,000 local mosques. So I'm just trying to understand, what is the function of the Grand Mosque within the day-to-day lives of Muslims in Abu Dhabi?
Sure. In Islam, we are encouraged to pray at the next door mosque. And the mosque here is kind of far away from neighborhood. So in terms of the number of worshippers on daily basis, we don't get that big number. Sure. But celebration days of Islam like Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Adha, we receive about 40,000 worshippers at once. You are in the middle of the courtyard, which can take about 22,000 worshippers. All the courtyard is made by mosaic marble. What really amazed me is that the marble is actually a living material. It's kind of a living creature, I would call it. It has some pores that allows the air to go in and out. Even though we are living in a very hot country, at the maximum heat, you will be able to walk on the courtyard without any issue. On the way, you can see these are lighting towers. Actually, the lighting system in the mosque is a very unique lighting system. It relies on the lunar phase. When it is the start of the month, the crescent would give kind of a bluish color through the lighting system that we have. The exterior part of the mosque would be showing that bluish color. When the month moves, the moon would be full and the lighting in the mosque would be white.
White. Within that whiteness, there is still a texture. There are sort of clouds that move across the building. Is that correct?
It is absolutely correct. I mean, even the movement of the clouds has been thought of. It's heading towards the main hall.
Off to each side of the courtyard too, there's these grand arcades that are a collection of the archways. they sort of have that look of when you place two mirrors bouncing from each other, you know, this reflection backwards and forwards with a slight curve. They're probably dead straight, but with, you know, they almost look endless, really.
These kind of symmetrical shapes, we call them, or this kind of repetition of architecture designs, is related somehow to the Islamic perspective. All the time, the engineers and the designers were always relying on the facts of Islam. This would show the infinite behavior of God.
On By Design on RN, you're hearing a recitation of the Quran at the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque in Abu Dhabi, at the gravesite of Sheikh Zayed. My God is Muhammad.
Now we are in the foyer area, or the main entrance, let's say, of the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque.
And so this main entrance is another one of these 50, 60-foot archways. The first thing that grabs you is the huge chandelier. I know that there are many chandeliers within the mosque. But
by the way, the one that you're seeing now is the is one of the smallest that we have. All of the chandeliers are made in Germany. The crystals, it's an Austrian-made crystals, and the glass used again is Murano Italian glass.
Now, you've been mentioning that the mosque itself, in both a design sense and a materials sense, is really quite a global collaboration.
The foyer area, or the main entrance, I mean, if you think about it as a big picture, this room only maybe have more than 15 countries at one time, and that's again proves the idea of tolerance and coexistence. Now we are heading.
The school children are just sort of swarming in behind us, trying to keep their voices down, but struggling, of course. And for any, you know, seven-year-old, this is a big ask.
It is really interesting to see the child when they come and to see the look, let's say. I do like that in this age of 7 years old, they think out of the box.
We're in the main hall now, and just to describe, it's about 50 metres across, would that be correct?
The size of the main hall is about 5,700 metres square.
And on the floor, this is the world's biggest carpet.
Yes, actually. The carpet that they're standing on is the largest hand-knotted carpet in the world. What really makes this building alive is that everything in the mosque is interconnected somehow. The wall, in Islam we call it Al-Qibla wall. Al-Qibla means the direction, literally. When we pray, we are required as Muslims to pray into the direction of Mecca, or the black cube. The only place where we don't is when we are in Mecca itself. That's why you can see them when they pray in circle. I mean, if you think about it, underneath the dome, there is the big chandelier that you can see here. If we go ahead and we go to the middle of the carpet, you can see that the center of the carpet is really a dot. And that dot is perpendicular to the center of the chandelier. And you know, when a water drop goes to the water, it reflects in circles on the surface of the water. It really amazed me when I think about it. In Mecca, people are in circle. And that circle expands from all over the world. That's what you can see here. It starts with a circle here with a bluish color, and then with a white color, to the red, to the yellow, and then it expands all over.
Wow.
Everything has a concept and an idea behind. Nothing is randomly chosen.
So I think what's kind of unique about the main prayer hall too is that there is really a great sense of peace. It's light, it's airy, it's detailed and reverent, but not in an oppressive way, if that makes sense. It's open. The temperature feels right in here. It gives you a certain feeling you wouldn't necessarily expect in such a large religious space.
Most of the people, when they think about mosques, they think about the ancient mosques like Blue Mosque, Taj Mahal, and the new mosques, not only in Abu Dhabi, but in all over the world. We are joining the best of design with the new technology that we have in order to have the modern place which shows the roots of Islam and the roots of the country.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
And by design, that was Mohammed Al-Hashemi, the tour guide from Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque in Abu Dhabi, there with Radio National's Timothy Nicastri.
And you can see some photographs of this spectacular building and some links on our By Design website. Coming up soon, our panel today focuses on sensory gardens, ones that are designed to evoke all of your senses as you walk through them: sight, smell, touch, hearing, and taste. But right now, it's time for the Design Files, and let's now join Studio 360's Design for the Real World and their story about that classic piece of American design, the Harley Davidson.
Get it up, number 11!
This is the Broken Spokes Loud Pipes Contest, where a bunch of bikes line up in the backyard of the bar and compete for best exhaust sound.
The central identifying element of the Harley-Davidson is the sound of its exhaust.
The Harley-Davidson is a loud, raucous, vibrating...
It's a V-twin.
Lumbering.
And then it goes boom, 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 boom.
Massive.
Two very big pistons going up and down.
Great lengths have been taken to assure that every Harley-Davidson has that same signature potato, 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 potato exhaust.
The potato-potato thing is really important. It's a vibration tied so directly to the hearts of riders and potential buyers that in the 1990s, Harley-Davidson responded to competition from Japanese manufacturers who were making Harley knockoffs by trying to trademark the sound. It didn't work, but it gives you an idea how much it matters.
Today, even, you know, I've been around motorcycles my entire life, I will hear a Harley-Davidson coming, and still in my brain, it triggers... Oh, here comes a really powerful motorcycle. It must be going 100 miles an hour, and then the Harley-Davidson goes by at 20 miles an hour. It has done its job.
A solidness and energy and forcefulness that people could respect, and that sense of American pride and might. Maybe we're nostalgic and wanting to hold on to that, and Harley-Davidson is a good way to do that.
So the very sound of this motorcycle is connected to America. Power and freedom flow from loud pipes tied to a big shiny engine. These are heavyweight machines. They look solid. Some have bags and chrome and lights galore. Others are stripped down. The hallmark is the V-twin engine in a low-slung frame. And there's very little plastic in these bikes. They look like the industrial power of America in its prime.
To many people in America... a motorcycle is a Harley-Davidson.
Early in the 20th century, there were over 200 motorcycle manufacturers, and Harley was the only remaining. So in terms of a specifically American icon, well, they're the only game in town.
From Studio 360's Design for the Real World, a bit about the American motorcycle, the iconic Harley-Davidson. Now, coming up next, something for all of your senses. We take a look, we smell, we touch, we taste, and we listen to sensory gardens. And to get you in the mood, this is a piece called Rain Smell from the gorgeous electronic artist called Baths.
I still smell you distance aside. I still smell the rain distance aside. Oh, water that had kept me alive. I will miss you distance aside. I still smell you distance aside. Still smell the rain distance aside. Oh, water that had kept me alive. I will miss you distance aside.
On By Design, Fenella Kernebone with you, and this is RN. That piece was from Baths, taken from his album Ceruleum, and that one is called Rain Smell. Now, sensory gardens are gardens that are designed to evoke all of your senses as you pass through them. These spaces are often meticulously designed with features such as strategically placed plants that brush against your face and legs, bright edible fruits, or even a smelly seat that crushes mint as you sit on it. However, on top of these sort of novelty spaces, sensory gardens are now being used to jumpstart growth and learning in children, and are even being used therapeutically for people suffering from dementia. So, are sensory gardens the way of the future for maximising what our garden spaces can do for us? My guests today are three sensory garden designers and enthusiasts. They are Jennifer Stackhouse, who is the former editor of Gardening Australia, Stephen Wells, a nurse and horticulturalist at the Royal Talbot Rehabilitation Centre in Melbourne, and Natasha Etherington, a horticultural therapist based in British Columbia in Canada. Welcome.
Thank you, Fenella.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen, to begin with you, you were named the Gardening Australia Gardener of the Year for your work designing a sensory garden in Melbourne. So could you start off by giving us a sense of what they might find there if I was to go along? What's there?
Yeah, certainly. It's a very interesting space because it's being within a hospital, it's not what people expect. So to enter into the space, there's elements that are visual, bright colours with the structural elements, but also with the foliage. So it's not necessarily just about the structural aspects of it, but the plant life, different flower, foliage colour, fragrance, and really design the space so there's areas for people to engage that may not necessarily be on top of each other. So there's space for people to have a bit of personal respite, but also other areas for communal gatherings and engagement with the garden.
Okay, so there's lots of different areas, and is it sort of undulating, private areas, things like that?
Essentially, it's all on the flat. But I've designed it in such a way that there are smaller spaces that feel a little bit more private, even though it's all within the one area.
Okay. And it's a space, ostensibly, for the patients of the rehabilitation centre to enjoy. What do they have to say about the garden?
They quite like it because, as I mentioned, it's not something that they expect. So for people, the people that I look after and that we have at the facility, there are adults that may have an acquired brain injury, spinal injury or stroke. So pretty significant injuries, and for them it's just a beautiful haven and an area for personal respite, but also I use it in a way with them that actually helps to evoke memories and different sensory experiences for them.
Okay.
And they love it.
How do they love it? How do you know?
Very good question. Being in a medical model environment, it's all about qualitative, but I get a lot of anecdotal engagement and a response from them. And it's just, I have the beauty of being able to work with them as a horticultural therapist. So it's not something that's just been put in and I've not had ongoing engagement. I work with them and it's through their contacts and through them as the patients, also their families and their children that actually come in and you see them having fun and engaging with it, smelling the plants, sharing it with those that they're with. I even had one patient who the leaf of a lamb's ear reminded him of his dog. So, you know, it's not just as it may present initially, and that's the exciting thing I love about sensory gardens.
Yeah, those inspire memory, nostalgia, many, many things like that. There are studies too, Stephen, that suggest that patients in hospitals who have access to gardens such as these, you know, views, sunlight, that they recover faster. What do you think?
Oh, yes, there's certainly some great research out there. And when that first research was done in America a few decades ago now, technology's changed. So it's harder to necessarily quantify in that respect. But there certainly is an improvement. We often reflect just on physical improvements, but there's also this emotional and the psychological side of it that's really important to capture.
Okay. And also, these sensory gardens have also been or are advocated for people who are suffering from dementia. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, there's some brilliant examples in aged care facilities, and that's where it's about the familiar. For a lot of people with dementia, the memory is significantly impaired. So it's actually, in some instances, been used quite well to reduce anxiety or reduce unsettled behaviour with some of the patients with dementia, residents, sorry.
Okay. Really interesting topic today. We're talking about sensory gardens here on By Design, and Jennifer Stackhouse is the former editor of Gardening Australia. Just stepping back a little bit here, Jennifer, could you give us an idea of the types of plants, the trees, the bushes that we might come across in a garden such as this?
Well, certainly, I mean, Steve just mentioned lamb's tongue, which is a silver-leafed, felty leaf plant, which is just a lovely sensory plant because it looks good and it also has this wonderful sense of touch. But lavender is one that's traditionally used, and it's often very important for people in those dementia areas, and it's a smell that lots of people remember from very early childhood, and it often invokes memories of their own grandparents and things like that. So, you know, lavender is a plant that's almost universally recognised and enjoyed in every sense. And I think salvias, the sages, are another one to always think about having because they do appeal to so many of the senses. The flowers themselves are often buzzing with bees, so you just get that extra dimension of having insects around you. You've got the colour of purples or reds, and the foliage is often very fragrant. So you've got lots of things coming together just in one plant.
So can you define, I mean, you've mentioned three plants so far, but the sorts of things that you're looking for to be included in a plant in a sensory garden, one that different types of plants that do all the senses.
That's right. Well, you've got to look at a plant and think, you know, what will give me those different things? So, you know, you look at the texture of the foliage, how it's pollinated, and that'll mean whether it attracts bees or butterflies or birds, the colours of the flowers, and whether it has flowers throughout the year or whether it maybe just has flowers at one time of the year, like something like a citrus, for example. When it's in bloom, the fragrance is amazing. And yet people would probably, if you said, oh, you should put a citrus in a sensory garden, they'd think it was because you could eat the fruit. But it's something that's got a lot more, you know, going for it. I think citrus is a good example of a sensory plant because it has so many different aspects to it. But, yes, looking at something that can be touched, felt, sat on, walked under, listened to, you know, bamboos and she oaks and things. So it's really looking at a plant and saying which one's going to give me as many different sensory experiences and that I can include in my garden.
Although, Stephen, I imagine you were trying to avoid plants that attracted bees.
Yes and no. And I think this is the thing what's important to focus on is that it's actually one plant doesn't fit everywhere, and it's often the combination of plants. And you know, for some, it's about the flowers because they attract the bees and bring in that insect life.
Certainly. Well, Natasha Etherington is a horticultural therapist based in British Columbia in Canada, where she joins us on the phone. And Natasha, you have a long history in creating gardens for children. So let's start off with children. How important is it for kids to get their hands dirty in the backyard?
It's very important, particularly in a school environment for children with special needs. They need a place, a sort of sanctuary where they can go for a sensory break, as it were. And really, a garden in a school should be viewed as an outdoor classroom.
And that's why across Canada, the UK, even here in Australia, there are dozens of schools that are building gardens on their grounds or incorporating it into their curriculum as well. Is part of this also due to the fact that more and more children are growing up without gardens in apartments, places like that?
There's definitely a disattachment. For instance, I put lettuces in the garden and asked the children what they were, and they didn't recognise them because they weren't in a plastic bag. And so again and again, we're seeing that children have been removed somewhat from the food growing process. But it's also an educational tool and a therapeutic tool. Children focus much better when they're outside, and you're seeing this rise in environmental schools as well happening, and it's just a wonderful place for them to feel relaxed and not judged and not rushed and learning outside.
Tell me a bit about some of the work that you've done. I know that you've advocated sensory gardens as a mode of therapy for children with autism spectrum or sensory processing disorders. How does gardening assist, I suppose, or show a different side to these children?
Well, it's important to note that children with autism spectrum disorder are unique. Some children are non-verbal, others are. You know, really, when you're working with children with special needs, you need to consider the strengths that they have. The garden is giving these children a much-needed sensory break from the sensory onslaught that they're experiencing in the classroom. Some children are sensitive to overhead lighting, to electricity, to smells. So you can imagine what a classroom does to you. It shuts you down. You're unable to learn, and it's not necessarily a positive experience. If you take a child outside into the garden, we always start in the digging block because that's a wonderful way to assess a child's nervous system, what they see, what they hear, how are they going to react, you know, if they've got heightened tactile defensiveness, are they actually going to go in the soil and work with it? But children immediately relax, and the key to horticultural therapy really is providing mentally engrossing activities so the child can relax, and then their sensory flow is alive, and you can see what you can work with and what you can do.
It's interesting to start in the digging plot for the children. How about here in Australia, in your garden, Stephen? Where do you start?
Quite often it's sitting around the potting up table, the propagation table, which sits right in the middle of the garden. In that situation, it's immersed within the garden space, and as Natasha was saying, you know, connecting with in that environment, it just relaxes a lot of people, and particularly for patients in a clinical environment, you know, it's quite important to get them outside of that to help them to relax and engage and get their hands dirty in the potting up table.
And how big is this kind of horticultural therapy in Australia, Stephen? Is it growing?
It's certainly growing, and I think there's a lot of people that are actually acutely aware of our disconnection with nature. So particularly in supported accommodation or aged care, hospitals, even schools, or across the board, and that's the great thing about horticultural therapy is that it's applicable to all ages and stages. People are actually certainly aware of that disconnection with nature and the importance to get that back.
Jennifer, we're talking about the therapeutic benefits of these sensory gardens, but to build them must be pretty labour-intensive, I imagine, to create these sorts of spaces. Can we talk a bit about the process of designing and building them? What are some of the things? How tricky is it, I suppose?
Well, I guess it really is depending on who your audience for the garden is going to be. If you just want to create a little haven for yourself, or perhaps that you can sit there with your elderly mother and enjoy a cup of coffee, well, you really need nothing more than a level surface and a place to sit and a few fragrant plants. But if you're going to have school children or people walking through the garden, then you need to consider the safety of it, how you're moving people from one level to another, and also how you're going to present the plants, because you may need raised garden beds so that the plants can tumble over the side of the garden as you're walking past, so that you are immersed in the fragrance or the feel of those plants. And also, because you are, I guess, assaulting their senses, you need to be aware that they might be completely engrossed in their surroundings and not notice if you've suddenly thrown a flight of steps, that you do need to really think about how people are going to be able to move around and what they'll be paying attention to.
And what about when things change? You know, obviously there are modern changes in gardens, such as houses. You know, gardens are always undergoing renovation, rebuilding, often with contemporary designs. How does that play into it?
I think contemporary designs actually lend themselves to sensory gardens, because people are keen to bring water into gardens even in quite minimal ways. So having a water feature that just trickles down a wall is quite possible nowadays without having an elaborate, you know, system of pumping and things like that, which you maybe needed in the past. And, you know, we also have solar lighting and these sorts of things. So in a way, I think modern technology can be used to create quite interesting sensory gardens in not a very expensive way.
Natasha, back to you. We're talking a bit about the therapeutic benefits of, well, obviously horticultural therapy, but of these sensory gardens. When you are working with children and you're in these spaces, what's it like when it works, when you're digging their plot and you have success, I suppose?
It's a great feeling of satisfaction. Really, with children with special needs, your main goal is to help build self-esteem. And the joy of working with children with ASD is that they're learning in context. And the research that's coming out on autism, the top people in the field are saying, really, they need to learn in context, and you're in the garden, so you're learning about horticulture and you're learning about yourself, self-awareness about what you like and what you don't like. And also, I mean, the thing about digging, which is wonderful, is it reverses negative associations with feeling sweaty and a racing heartbeat, which, you know, if you're an anxious child, that's a pretty negative association for you, but we can turn that round and make it into a positive association.
Jennifer was just talking about contemporary design. How does that play in with you and with your gardens as well? When something needs to be updated, renovated, things like that, what happens?
A garden is always evolving like the seasons, so that's not a problem, and I think gardeners love that challenge, actually, of evolving and moving parts around. And children for sure love to move things around, and they're learning, you know, what grows in the shade, what grows in the sun, even amending plant situations, so trying to make, create a condition that a plant would growing. You can show them how, if they take their medication, it's like a plant. When we amend the soil, when we try and address the pH balance, it's much like what we have to do sometimes when we have to take medication. So there's many analogies, you know, sexual reproduction, all these sort of things that they can learn in the garden that are in context, and it just makes sense to them. And really, contemporary design just helps us. We're learning all the time. We have a snoozle lawn in our garden, and that's a lawn built for a child with cerebral palsy. It's sort of graded up to about 3 foot on a slope, and that's really for children who are wheelchair bound, who can be lifted out easily by their carers or the occupational therapist. They can stretch on the lawn, they can look up, look at the birds on the branches above them, and they can gain a sense of outside, which unfortunately many children with special needs are not getting as much of as they should.
It's certainly a good insight into the fact that it's more than the plants that you need to have in the garden, but the shape, the design of the space as well, the landscape. Stephen, what just some top picks before we wrap up, some Australian natives or perhaps easy to grow examples to get our sensory garden started? What do you recommend?
Australian natives are good, but I'm a bit of a stickler for some of the pelargoniums, the centre geraniums, but also succulents. There's some fantastic textures and colours of those that just surprise you and bring a great sensory texture.
Jennifer, your favourite plants? You've mentioned lavender. What else?
Lavender's great. Now, I think she-oaks are fantastic. You can make a grove of she-oaks that you could just get lost sitting in the middle of a grove of she-oaks. The noise of the wind blowing through them and the needles falling down, you get a soft cushion effect underneath them that you could walk on bare feet or you could sit on. I think she-oaks just create a wonderful thing. And there's one actually called Cousin It, which is a compact one that just looks like Cousin It. It's kind of a amorphous mass of green, and children love that. You can stick a hat on it or a pair of sunglasses and dress it up into a character.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And Natasha, I know you're from the UK, but you're based in Canada now. What about a plant, something in the garden that smells really good?
Well, I'd recommend all herbs, but really the showstopper for me with children is the sunflower.
Some really fantastic ideas, and I do thank all of my guests today here on By Design talking about sensory gardens. Jennifer Stackhouse, who's the former editor of Gardening Australia, Stephen Wells, a nurse and horticulturalist at the Royal Talbot Rehabilitation Centre in Melbourne, and Natasha Etherington, a horticultural therapist based in Canada. Thank you for joining me on By Design today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on By Design's summer series, we visit a home on an oddly shaped sloping block of land where the architects had a whole lot of other elements to contend with.
And it does have an existing caretaker's cottage which is over 100 years old, and that had to be retained. Not only that, there's also a neighbouring heritage listed dance hall which is over 100 years old too, and it's built 2 metres into our land. And then the adjoining workers' cottage is also built into our land. So that obviously has cut down the actual buildable area of the site significantly.
That's the leftover space house coming up next week on By Design. But that is the show for today, produced by Diane Dean and Jan Ryan. Our sound engineer is the fantastic Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. And my name is Fenella Kernebone. See you next time.